This week, on Behind the Lens. From schools to prisons, homes to businesses, there is nothing in our region that's not impacted by the coronavirus. We'll hear from Lens reporters covering a community in crisis. We get a situation report from infectious diseases physician Mark Allen Derry. Author historian John M. Barry talks about his research on the last great pandemic. How did society cope then? And we'll talk about the state of the news industry amid an economic catastrophe. I'm Tom Wright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, brought to you by Community Support. Learn more at thelensnola.org/donate. Welcome to our listeners on WAMF LP 90.3 FM and 102.3 FM WHIV LP New Orleans. Oakdale Federal Detention Facility sits about 3 hours' drive from downtown New Orleans, but the interests of the people being held there are awfully close to our own in the middle of a pandemic. We're learning just how easily something like COVID-19 can put all of us into our cages. Reporter Nick Krastel is following the crisis in our prison system.
Oakdale is made up of three different jail facilities. There are two main buildings. One of them has about 900 prisoners. One of them has about 750. And then there's a small minimum security camp that is about 140 prisoners. Until this week, all the confirmed cases of coronavirus had been in one single facility known as FCI Oakdale 1, which has about 900 inmates. This week, I've been in touch with a number of the prisoners in the minimum security camp, and they have told me that they were informed by prison staff that someone in their camp had tested positive. That person was removed from the camp and isolated, but these guys all live together in a dormitory-style situation where they have bunk beds that are all, you know, within feet from one another. They're not isolated in individual cells. There's no possibility of social distancing. And they all, it sounds like, you know, there's about six showers for all 140 of them to share. So hearing that one of them had tested positive was really bad news. And there's a lot of fear going on there right now. More recently, it seems that they're starting to release prisoners from this camp. I've heard from a number of inmates that about 12 to 20 inmates have been told that they're going to be released. They're going to be quarantined first and then sent home. I'm trying to get confirmation from the Bureau of Prisons that's true. But so far, they have said that there's no data readily available for individual facilities, although they are increasing home confinement throughout the federal prison system currently.
And these inmates that they're looking at releasing, are these nonviolent offenders?
The Attorney General issued a memo to the Director of Prisons recently, specifically saying that they should make efforts to reduce the prisoner population by increasing home confinement, and specifically at Oakdale 1 and a few other of these facilities that are having serious outbreaks.
And that's U.S. Attorney General William Barr, correct?
Yes, precisely. Yes, okay. Yes. So among the things that he suggested be the criteria for these home confinement releases were low-risk, nonviolent offenders, also people who are close to having their prison terms fulfilled. So what Barr was able to do, or what he claimed to be able to do in this memo, was to extend the period of time that a prisoner would be eligible for home confinement. So normally, I believe a prisoner is eligible either when they only have 10% of their sentence remaining, or 6 months, whichever one is the shortest. So he expanded that time frame, and it's not clear to me exactly how far he did. But it sounds like a lot of these guys who are getting released right now are people who are close to having finished their sentences. It does not yet sound like, from what I'm hearing, that these are necessarily the most medically vulnerable people in the facility. But like I say, as I hear more from both inmates and the Bureau of Prisons, I will keep you updated.
And I'll note, it seems like you've had an easier time in some ways speaking with the inmates than the people who are guarding them.
That is most certainly the case, that it's been a clear line of communication right now with the inmates, specifically the inmates in this minimum security camp. Right now in the other two facilities, they're on lockdown, meaning that they are primarily confined to their cells and have much more limited access to phones and internet. So that's the reason why a lot of my information is coming from the prisoners in this minimum security camp. They're just much more have much more freedom to communicate with the outside world. I was actually able to speak on the phone to a prisoner, a man named Anthony Fields.
I try to keep myself clear. I stay hydrated. I've been exercising as much as I can. But the worry, yeah, you can't help but to worry. Because I can explain it to you, Nick, but it's like someone trying to explain the Vegas lights to you. If you're not there, you just can't imagine it. You can't imagine how this is unless you're here inside these walls. It's bad. I'm telling you, it's literally like watching a sci-fi movie. Did you hear that?
Yeah.
You hear those guys? That same strange cough, you hear it all night long.
Is going on
literally
right now?
It's bad, yeah.
Anthony Field speaking there from minimum security at Oakdale. Nick, remind us about the ACLU's lawsuit regarding these Oakdale inmates.
Yeah, so the ACLU filed a lawsuit this week, a class action on behalf of prisoners at Oakdale and specifically medically vulnerable prisoners at Oakdale, demanding their immediate release. So the ACLU is arguing basically that prisoners being confined, medically vulnerable prisoners who they define as anyone over 50 years old and people with pre-existing health conditions that can make them vulnerable to coronavirus, that holding them in Oakdale violates their Eighth Amendment right against cruel and unusual punishment.
Let's get back to town and talk about the situation at the Orleans Justice Center. You've heard from the sheriff's office. What are they reporting there?
So far at the Orleans Justice Center, the New Orleans jail, there are currently 13 prisoners. This is according to their update yesterday. So that would be Wednesday's update. And they're reporting that they have 13 inmates in custody who have tested positive for coronavirus. That's actually down from 15 on Tuesday. They have released a number of prisoners who had tested positive. The jail has been in touch with the Department of Corrections, the State Department of Corrections, and they're considering transferring some of the prisoners being held at the Orleans Justice Center to state facilities, so specifically to Angola or Allen Correctional Facility.
Finally, Nick, you followed Monday this motorcade protest.
Yeah, I mean, this was a protest, a socially distant protest of cars that drove by the Orleans Justice Center, which is demanding a further decrease in the jail population due to coronavirus. It was organized by the New Orleans Workers Group. So this was really, this protest is part of this broad push that we've seen in the last few weeks to really reduce the jail population. You know, medical experts have been warning that if there's an outbreak in a jail, it can be horribly detrimental, not just for the prisoners inside, but for the community at large. There was dozens of cars. I'm not sure exactly how many, but it stretched for, you know, two or three blocks. And they drove around the jail. They drove around the juvenile justice center. They drove around the ICE field office, the Immigration Customs Enforcement field office here in New Orleans. And we're really just calling for a release of nonviolent prisoners, both locally and throughout the state.
Okay. And certainly immigrant detainees in federal custody at this time, of which there are several thousand in Louisiana, are another point of concern as far as the potential spread of this disease, this virus within our prison populations. Nick Krastel, I want to thank you yet again for excellent work on the criminal justice beat. Stay safe.
Thanks, Tom. You too.
Louisiana public schools probably will stay closed for the rest of the academic year. That's according to Governor John Bel Edwards. Marta Jusen has that and more in education news.
So a number of school district superintendents in Louisiana wrote a letter to the governor this week asking that he keep school buildings closed through the end of the academic year. We've just confirmed that Superintendent Henderson Lewis, who leads the NOLA Public Schools District, is one of those officials who supports the move to keep schools closed for the year.
Whose call is that? Is that the State Department of Education or the governor himself?
It's ultimately up to the governor. And up until now, the State Department of Education says they support the governor's decision. They have also penned a new letter today, Acting Superintendent Beth Snow did, saying that she would support him in closing the schools if he decided it was a safety issue. But that if he did go forward with that plan, she wants to ensure that all schools have a remote learning plan, because they say this is a critical time for, you know, students to keep up their education.
Yeah, understood there. And, you know, with that in mind, I mean, with the stay home orders still in place, there has been this dramatic shift in education locally toward at home learning. So how are NOLA Public Schools trying to meet that challenge?
Right. So NOLA Public Schools actually basically right the same day that this stay-at-home order went into effect, the district got $5 million approved in emergency funding, and they've used that to purchase hotspots and laptops that they are sending to schools this week and then hoping to distribute to families within the next week.
I want to move to one of your latest reports on Lusher Charter School in Uptown New Orleans. You know, parents are still awaiting admission lottery results for their kindergarten age kids. Why is this lottery so highly anticipated, as you describe it in your reporting?
Yeah, so Lusher is well known in the city as an A-rated school, and it's it's very highly competitive to get a seat there. Seats are reserved first for younger siblings of students, and there's also a certain number set aside for Tulane employees as children. So these seats can be very hard to get. Additionally, students must take a test. Their parents have to go to an admissions test, and their parents have to go to a meeting. There's a number of factors that lead ultimately to a score, and then depending on what your student's score is, they get placed into a tiered lottery. Okay. And this year in kindergarten, there are about 400 kids seeking 100 spots.
Wow. Okay. So, yeah, that is somewhat competitive. So how did the lockdown impact this lottery?
The only thing we know is that it is delayed. We don't know the exact mechanism for why it's delayed. These traditionally have been in person. And I believe the other lotteries for older grades were still held in person, although the public wasn't allowed in, but they broadcast them on YouTube so people could still see. I do know that some kindergartners still need to take their test again. Students can take a test again if they are granted or if they appeal and then are granted the ability to retest. So that could definitely be a cause for delay.
Meantime, their older classes through senior year, I believe you reported those were completed in mid-March, correct?
Right. Yep. All the older grades, their lotteries have already been completed. And so we don't know the exact reason for this delay, but a spokeswoman for Lusher said they hope to set a date by the end of next week.
Okay. Marta, really appreciate you just keeping us on point with education news. Is there anything else that you're keeping an eye on in terms of news from the schools?
Yeah, we just want people to know that schools are still doing the community feeding sites on Mondays and Wednesdays. And if you do need technology in your house, you're supposed to talk to your individual school about that, not the district. And then the lens is just, you know, we're here for you, and we're curious how it's going to educate your children at home. So feel free to reach out to me. My email address is mjuson@thelensnola.org. I'd be happy to hear from you anytime, and I hope everyone's staying healthy.
Marta Jusen on education for the Lens. Marta, as always, thank you, and do stay safe.
Thank you. You too, Tom.
Dr. Mark Allen Derry has been helping us in our coverage throughout this emergency. He is an infectious diseases expert leading the COVID-19 response for the Access Health Louisiana Network of Clinics. You know, when we last spoke with you for the podcast, as I recall, you were helping set up some of those drive-through testing sites that are actually shutting down tomorrow on Friday of this week. Is that right?
That's my understanding, is that the drive-through testing sites are going to be closed tomorrow. But literally, like, I think 5 minutes ago, there was an alert on my phone that said that the feds were going to be reversing their decision for rescinding that funding, and that if localities, I quickly clicked on the story, and if localities wanted to indeed continue the testing, they could. But I don't know where Orleans Parish is with that.
I do want to mention that the advisories we've seen as well remind that testing is now available at many of your hospitals and doctor's offices, as well as the Ilario Center in West Wego, if I recall.
Right, that's right. And the other thing to be very clear is that we are going to start seeing a huge influx of rapid tests for the virus. So these rapid PCR tests, where you'll get the results in about 15 minutes, as well as antibody testing. So we're going to be able to not only tell with one group of tests whether or not you are actively infected with COVID-19, but there's a second group of tests that are going to be coming out as well, that we're going to probably see over the course of the next couple of weeks, that are going to be able to tell whether or not you had been exposed to it and whether or not you have now antibodies to the virus.
We at the Lens have been watching a certain pronounced decline in recent days in terms of the overall use of ventilators, at least in Region 1, the New Orleans area. What could you tell me about the ventilator situation and other supplies here?
I mean, I saw that report of ventilator use being less very recently. So that's good. So it doesn't seem like we've hit a maximum for ventilators, and that's really good news. I think that the issue with respect to supplies is our PPEs. And there, you know, again, we got hit with this so rapidly, and the whole globe did suddenly, that everybody needed PPEs all of a sudden. There's just only so many manufacturers and distributing infrastructure that could supply it at any one time. And so when, you know, everybody needs something at once, and the whole world needs the same exact thing at once, of course, you can imagine that those supplies will be limited. You know, I think that as a medical society, we all kind of got very creative about how to reuse some of these supplies. And so these N95 masks, which are very, you know, these respirators are very valuable for the frontline workers, for physicians, nurses, or whoever is actually going to be evaluating somebody with us COVID-19. Those are the masks that help keep the virus out, as opposed to the cloth masks, surgical mask, or the handkerchiefs, or face masks. Those keeps the virus in for folks that are wearing those masks. But for physicians or nurses or what have you that are actually seeing COVID-19 patients, they need to have those N95 respirators, and that keeps the virus out. And so when you're asking somebody to evaluate a COVID-19 patient, they need to have all of protection that they possibly can. And that mask is the most important of the protection, because the virus gets in through the respiratory route, either oral pharynx or nasopharynx. We're seeing hospitals are doing super creative things where they're using either ultraviolet lights to sanitize masks, and they're figuring out ways of being able to kind of clean the mask down or what have you. And let me be very clear with you about this, Tom. We've never had to do this before. The idea of having to reuse an N95, that's just never been a thing in the in the healthcare system, or at least here in the U.S.
Yeah.
And so it certainly has been somewhat challenging and forcing us to kind of find new ways of being able to extend the life of these life-saving entities.
Remind people of some of your service abroad in terms of fighting infectious diseases.
Yeah, I mean, most recently I was in Sierra Leone with the World Health Organization, where I was doing evaluation of with the Ebola epidemic. I worked on the, you know, in Freetown doing clinical epidemiology, finding folks who are positive, and then doing contact tracing. In the past, I've, you know, done some hantavirus evaluation up in the Navajo Reservation, Lhasa virus epidemic evaluation in Zirakori, Guinea.
In terms of having to do your work in community clusters for some of these illnesses that you have had to respond to in the past, have you ever had to reuse a lot of your PPE to the degree that you and some of your colleagues are now?
Never, ever. When I was in Freetown, the idea of using PPE that we utilize to evaluate folks with Ebola virus disease, this is an unheard of thing. But again, for Ebola, again, that was happening in one small part of the world.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like the whole world needed PPE all at once.
Right.
And then all the supply chains got clogged, or, you know. But remember, a lot of these materials are also sourced and or made in China. And China was locked down up until a couple of days ago. Certainly Wuhan was. Everybody was needing something all of a sudden all at once. But the place that we were needing it from was locked down. And so the workers and suppliers and factories and that whole chain infrastructure that existed to supply materials and or the actual PPE just was shut down because the country was shut down. And it really speaks to the importance moving forward once we are in a post-COVID-19 world about what we can do to avoid things like this again in the future.
You've been working consistently throughout this crisis within the local medical community here. As a whole, you have responded to this crisis. Can you give me a sense, beyond the stats, beyond the raw numbers, of just give me a sense of what you're feeling right now? I mean, as healthcare workers and simply as human beings at this stage in this long-term response.
I am shocked more than anything else at, you know, I've known I've wanted to do infectious diseases for, you know, since I was a teenager, right? So I've been reading books and studying the history of pandemics and what have you for a really, really long time. So if you were to ask me, are you surprised that this was happening? No, the answer is no. But I think even myself, who's so critical and very analytical about our American healthcare system, I did not realize the extent by which we would be caught so unawares, how we don't have a public health infrastructure that can immediately jump into place. You know, January 19th, 2020 is a notable day. January 19th, 2020 was the first case here in the U.S., and it was the first case in South Korea, okay? So those were the first two cases, January 19th, 2020. We did not really institute a strong testing program for another 6 weeks after that. South Korea was able to initiate testing probably right away. And not only that, they were doing 20,000 tests a day. And Germany, at their high point, was testing 50,000 people a day. So what we are lacking here, not only did were we caught unawares in the setting of we don't have enough PPE, and also we did not have an infrastructure to ramp up testing so that we could do that contact tracing. Had we had on January 19th, we had our first positive and we had done extensive contact tracing and testing, we could have contained it immediately and tried to have kept it on the and contained it. Unfortunately, that just didn't happen, you know, and it was to a large degree we sat on our laurels. Now, we have a history of doing that here in the U.S., and I would point to HIV. With HIV, it was a very, very similar situation. At one point, we knew, or at least we had a very good idea of people who were HIV positive in like 1984. The CDC had done excellent contact tracing, and we could have at that time contained HIV, at least here in the U.S., and that just didn't happen, largely due to the politics of the time and what have you. And of course now, New Orleans is, you know, one of the is one of the top cities for the new cases of HIV. We've been number two and number three, and I think we're down to number five or six in the last year or so. But we've been in the top cities in the country for new cases of HIV for decades, really. And so we did kind of the same thing here with COVID-19. We just kind of sat on our laurels. And I think moving forward, I think it's real important for us to consider kind of public health as being far more of a priority in our society so that we don't get caught in, you know, unawares again moving forward, because we probably will see something like this again. I mean, I make the offhanded comment that, you know, we're seeing COVID-19 today, but we may see COVID-22 pretty soon as well.
Right.
And this is largely due to kind of climate change and the fact that as humans were kind of, you know, penetrating deeper into parts of the world that we've never been. And so the ecological niches of these viruses, in particular these fruit bats that carry this coronavirus, there's more human interaction, and we could see something like this happening again in the future. And this coronavirus is a really it's very good at what it does in terms of it's very infectious. It transmits to people when they're asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic or even post-symptomatic. So you could be transmitting the virus to people and not even know that you are. And that's a evolutionary advantage to the virus because it gets as many hosts as possible.
And we're not just talking about 48 hours. We're talking about several days.
Absolutely. You know, Dr. Redfield from the CDC last week had come out and said that 25% of those that tested positive in the U.S. Were completely asymptomatic. And that's ultimately what led to the recommendation for everybody to start wearing those cloth masks out and about now, because we don't know who's positive. You may be the person listening right now. You may be positive. I'm talking directly to you. You may be positive. You don't know it. So it's imperative upon you to wear a cloth mask so you don't transmit your virus to other people. But Tom, I will say this. Iceland tested their country. They tested 5% of the people in their country. That was the sample size they were looking for. And what they found was 50% of those people who tested positive also were asymptomatic. 50%. So we have somewhere between 25 and 50% may not even know that they have COVID-19, and yet they're probably transmitting the virus to other people. We're going to have a better idea of what that is when we look backwards, and that's called retrospectively, when we do these sero surveillance studies. That's, in other words, we're going to be measuring people's antibodies, and we'll be able to determine who was actually positive for the COVID-19 virus or who wasn't based upon looking at their antibodies. You know, I think that this is a very, very stressful time for the frontline workers, the doctors and the nurses. And I also just want to quickly just a quick aside, just also just tip my hat to my heroes. And these are the folks that are driving the RTAs, the grocery clerks, the food delivery folks, the pharmacy techs, the folks that are pushing brooms. These are the folks that are also frontline as well. I just wanted to just kind of show my appreciation and let them know that those are my personal heroes.
Dr. Mark Allen Derry speaking to us on Thursday evening. Coming up, John Berry on his book and the painful lessons of pandemic history, and Karen Gavois and Charles Maldonado talk shop. You're listening to Behind the Lens on live stream, on podcast, on our community radio partners, 102.3 FM WHIV LP and 90.3 FM WANF LP New Orleans. This podcast is also available on our partners' website, neworleanslocal.com.
Hi, I'm Harry Shearer. You're hearing it from everyone these days, stay home and stay safe. Well, I'd like to wind the calendar back just about 14 years. Here in New Orleans, we had a challenge that was truly existential. We were not only gutting our houses down to the studs, we were gutting our lives, if we still had them, down to the studs. We've rebuilt New Orleans one home, one store, one restaurant at a time. We did it. What we're asked to do now is child's play by comparison. We're gutting our social lives down to the studs temporarily. As in the days after the flood, we're depending on each other to keep the city and ourselves afloat. But for most of us, all we really need to do to slow down and eventually stop this pandemic is simply stay home and stay safe. There's plenty of time to gather, work, parade, and party when this thing is over. The more we self-isolate now, the sooner that day will come. Thanks.
New Orleans native John M. Berry counts the Great Flood of 1927, Hurricane Katrina, and the 1918 Great Influenza among the major disasters he has researched. His 2004 book on that 20th century pandemic has become a bestseller once again as people worldwide cope with a 21st century disaster. John Berry spoke with us by phone this week. Mr. Berry, what prompted you to write The Great Influenza?
It was actually almost an accident. I wanted to write about the home front in World War I, culminating in events in 1919. The way I scoped out that book would have taken me a minimum of 7 years, probably longer. At that time, I was living on an advance. I didn't think I could get an advance big enough to cover that. It's a pretty big number to live decently for 7 years minimum and pay research costs. So I thought I could subsidize research in the same time period by writing about the pandemic. I thought I could do that book very quickly, 2 years. I was mistaken. It took 7 years.
I wanted to read a short excerpt. The final lesson of 1918, a simple one, yet one most difficult to execute, is that those in authority must retain the public's trust. The way to do that is to distort nothing, to put the best face on nothing, to try to manipulate no one.
Well, by that standard, I would say John Bell has done pretty well. And you can judge for yourself how well you think the White House has done.
You wrote about the 1918 influenza. It was widely known as the Spanish flu. I recall learning as a child about the Spanish flu.
Well, I thought that I know I tracked down the first case reported anywhere in the world of a lethal outbreak of influenza, which was in late January in Haskell County, Kansas. And based on that, and based on the fact that you could by name see people move from that community and they had influenza in their family to Fort Riley, which it was the first known widespread outbreak. I thought that I might possibly have found the site of origin and even wrote a scientific journal article on it. You know, that was 16 years ago. There's been a lot of work that's been done since the book came out. It's still possible that was where it began, but I think it's more likely it started in China. Other hypotheses advance Vietnam and France is where it began. We will never actually know where it started. The world, much of Europe and the U.S. was at war. Europe censored its press. We had self-censorship here, which was pretty extreme, but still self-censorship. They didn't want to write anything negative about anything. They thought it would hurt the war effort. Spain was not at war. Their press wrote about it. The king got sick, got a lot of attention, and it became known as Spanish flu. That first wave was actually quite mild and did not hit every place. There were large parts of the world that were untouched by that first wave.
The spread here in the States at the time forced leadership to really mobilize who they could in terms of healthcare workers, medical researchers, and some of that research being done for the first time at this scale. I'd ask you to tell me a little bit about Paul Lewis, the Navy officer who you write about a bit.
I opened and closed the book with Paul Lewis, and my wife even suggested I dedicate the book to his spirit, which I did. I was kind of moved by his story. Essentially, every medical scientist in the country was incorporated into the military. What is now Rockefeller University, the entire place called Rockefeller Institute of Medical Research became part of the Army. All the scientists became captains, majors, colonels, except for one of the best scientists there, Oswald Avery, who was a Canadian, so they only made him a corporal. Lewis was in Philadelphia. A brilliant man in 1908, he had proved polio was a viral disease, even though they didn't actually know what viruses quite were at that time.
Right.
2 years later, he produced a vaccine 100% protective of monkeys against polio. He was a pretty good scientist. And he, like many others in the country and elsewhere in the world, struggled to produce a vaccine. They didn't know how to make vaccines. They'd solved quite a few health problems with vaccines. But you have to know the pathogen that you're targeting with the vaccine in order for that to be successful. And they could not figure out what caused influenza. They had several different hypotheses, none of which were right. They produced a vaccine. It was generally considered that a bacteria that still has influenza in its name, Haemophilus influenza, they thought that was the cause. A lot of people did. Others thought it was the pneumococcus. They developed an anti-pneumococcus, pneumococcal vaccine, which was fairly successful against that target. But it did not get widely distributed beyond some army camps. And if you get an anti-pneumonia vaccination today, it's a straight line descendant of that. But most people probably died of secondary bacterial pneumonia, certainly a lot, whether it was most or not. You know, the H flu, Haemophilus influenza, was not the cause, so that vaccine might help you if by chance you ended up being infected by that bacteria. Wouldn't it help you if the virus itself was doing the damage or if another bacteria was? You know, they scrambled around quite a bit. They were very good scientists, but their knowledge and tools were quite limited, certainly compared to today. They didn't have supercomputers. They didn't know what a virus was.
They didn't know how to grow a virus. Bacteria grow in media, basically any food you have, you mix that in and, you know, bacteria will eat it. But viruses need living cells to replicate in. They have to have a cell culture. They didn't know how to do that at the time. You know, so for all of those scientists, it was tremendously frustrating. They're trying to save lives and risking their own lives in the process.
Yeah.
We're unsuccessful.
Doctors, nurses, et cetera, simply don't have any immunity because they're trained healthcare personnel, though they do know more than most about how to avoid infection.
Right. In fact, a point worth making, I know, you know, I got involved 15 or so years ago in the pandemic preparedness effort, given a lot of talks about it over the years. And I had always said that one of the unknowns was healthcare workers. Because in 1918, you knew if you became a doctor or a nurse that you were going to face an infectious disease, which meant you were going to put yourself at some risk, and maybe a lot of risk. But people generally don't die today of infectious diseases. So healthcare workers don't go into that profession expecting to risk their own lives by dealing with infectious disease. So the question was whether healthcare workers could perform their tasks if faced with something like this. And in fact, they are doing so with incredible courage. And I just have, I cannot express the amount of respect that I have for them. And we're not even giving them the tools to protect themselves that they need. And they're still risking their lives.
What you found in terms of the public impact, the public response, if you will, to this influenza of that era? I mean, how did your average neighbor react?
Well, if you were living back then, you probably wouldn't know because you'd never see that neighbor.
Yeah.
No, there was, you know, less done by order than by fear. They did close in most cities, certainly here in New Orleans, closed, you know, schools, bars, you know, theaters and so forth. They didn't close the society down. They didn't close all other businesses down. Didn't close factories down. But many of these places were effectively closed by huge numbers of people staying home out of fear. You know, well over half the workforce, either because they were afraid or they were caring for someone who was sick or they were sick themselves. So the economy really did grind close to a halt, not quite a halt, because of absenteeism. But there was less information out there. And what information was out there was frequently a lie. Because we were at war, Wilson, the president, had created a propaganda machine, which was designed to tell lies to, quote, keep morale up, unquote. And influenza fitted into that infrastructure. As a result, a national public health leader said, this is ordinary influenza by another name. It was known, as you said earlier, as Spanish flu. Another national leader said, you have nothing to fear if ordinary precautions are taken.
Certainly not the case.
People do perfectly well. This was not ordinary influenza by another name. People could die in less than 24 hours after the first symptoms. Some of the symptoms were horrific. I mean, most cases were ordinary influenza. But a minority of those cases, and when you first started to get sick, you didn't know if you were going to progress to a severe case or whether it was going to be like ordinary influenza. A minority of those cases were quite different, you know, even to the extent that, you know, one of the most horrific symptoms would be you could bleed not only from your nose and mouth, but from your eyes and ears. Now, that was not that common, but it happened. And among soldiers in some studies, 15% had a nosebleed. But even that can be a little bit scary, much less if you're bleeding, see somebody bleeding from their eyes.
Sure.
So since people were being generally lied to, and they could see this was something very unique and very frightening. There was a lot more fear and panic even than is the case today. And that kept people more isolated. You know, I'm in the quarter. My wife and I go for walks a couple of times a day, actually. And I've walked up down Audubon Park and on Coliseum Square sometimes. And, you know, we are all out there and we're all socially distancing and avoiding people on the street. You know, if somebody's sitting on a stoop, I'll walk on the street. But we're friendly. We kind of laugh about it. It's almost a community spirit type thing, is we're all avoiding each other. You didn't really get that in 1918. In 1918, it was more just fear. Don't come near me. Like people would draw guns on each other if somebody threatened to be too close. It's a different feeling. You know, I've anecdotally, just my own experience here, is in most disasters, community comes together. People support each other. It certainly happened here after Katrina. And I get the feeling that's the way things are now here as well. I certainly hope so, and it's certainly been my personal experience.
John M. Barry, author of The Great Influenza, and not a few other books that Louisianans need to be reading. Mr. Barry, I can't thank you enough for the time, and I hope you and your family stay safe and well.
Okay, thank you, and the same to you.
Author John Barry is a distinguished scholar at Tulane's Bywater Institute and a professor at the Tulane School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. One thing that history has not always prepared us well for is how journalists can continue to cover catastrophe for the public when the catastrophe itself is driving our financial support into the ground. We're very much as susceptible to the sort of economic pressures you're facing at home, and we wanted to spend a little time to speak frankly about these issues in the closing minutes of this program. I introduce you to Karen Gabois, founding director of The Lens, and our chief news editor, Charles Maldonado. Let me preface it with this. We take a lot of pride at The Lens. I know you, Karen, and you, Charles, certainly do in being a nonprofit news outlet. I wonder sometimes if that's a little bit lost to some news consumers out there. Not all by any means, and certainly we've got a great base of support out there. But I wonder, Karen, to begin with, I wonder if you might talk a little about what you are seeing when you're able to step back from the daily task list and really look at the state of our news industry. And it is an industry, let's face it, whether you're commercial or nonprofit or public or private.
Well, of course, as soon as this restaurants and bars in New Orleans began to close, as well as other commercial businesses, I knew that the for-profit folks here in town, whether it's TV or newspaper, were going to be having a hard time with their business model in particular. But that those same folks that work in that industry are also readers and supporters of The Lens, so that the trickle-down would come our way as well. We do rely also on major foundations, but with the drop in the stock market, you know, you're always unsure of what exactly the financial, you know, solid footing that those foundations may have been on a month ago. That situation may change for them as well. So I keep a close eye on what others are seeing, doing, and feeling, while at the same time making sure that we stay in touch with those supporters to see, you know, what direction they're taking. And we have seen some major changes in terms of sort of rapid response where, for instance, we applied for and received a $5,000 Facebook grant, and that was really sort of a rapid response to those of us in the news industry, which included also for-profit outlets getting a piece of that.
Sure.
We're also applying for another larger, I think it's $25 million. Of course, we won't be eligible for $25 million.
But, seems the same.
It's a larger effort on Facebook's part, recognizing that the news industry actually is their, you know, that we're their content providers. So if we go away, they're left with, I don't know, cat photos and deep state videos. Just kidding.
Indeed. Well, that's probably our next engagement strategy. Charles, I would ask you, and of course, we're, you know, when we talk about economic support for newscasting, for journalism, you know, when it clearly, you know, the commercial news sector, the is very dependent on advertising. And as advertising dwindles in an economic downturn of any kind, news media, commercial media, but also nonprofits as well, find themselves in much the same way that Karen is talking about, in the red, if you will, in a financial pinch. And we are already starting to see some of the major, I will say, out-of-town mass media owners coping financially.
I do know that, you know, locally we are seeing some news outlets, including you know, a Tegna owned station making some cuts, you know, in the form of furloughs. And, you know, it's when it comes to commercial media, you are going to see these effects much more quickly because it hits them directly in advertising. When it comes to nonprofit media, you know, it's not as if we're immune from the economy, as Karen was saying. You know, people, you know, charitable giving goes down when we hit an economic recession. Foundations, the big foundations, which are reliant on, you know, some of which are reliant on corporate giving, some of which have significant amount of their resources invested in the stock market, things are going to get tighter there. You know, for us, we have, you know, we've been lucky thus far in this nightmare to have seen a lot of generosity directly from our readers, and we have, you know, seen some, you know, medium-sized to large donations coming in, but it's not to say that we are anywhere close to being, you know, out of a semi-crisis mode, you know, it's worrisome for everyone. The amazing thing about that is that in some ways our product has never been more valuable, in the sense that more people are using it than usually do. You know, our readership is hugely up, 4 or 5 times what it normally is. You know, subscriptions, you know, reportedly subscriptions at the Times-Picayune New Orleans Advocate are up. But, you know, there are bigger forces at play in the economy here.
I do want to say that we did take a gamble this week and engaged a healthcare reporter to come on and look at the specific, all our beats have healthcare in them, because
right,
it's the overlying theme of everything we're writing about. But we did engage a healthcare reporter, and we sent a plea to some of our larger funders, and they responded immediately. But we are short about $15,000 to make that position, make that reporting a larger part of what we're doing. And I think that we have had a good response from our readers too in that story, the first story we published, and we're looking forward to publishing more. So it's a sort of gamble because, you know, we're extending our payroll that we have to meet every week, every 2 weeks. But at the same time, going a little bit on faith that this is the news that people want to read. This is the information that they want available to them. And that's what we're going to do and figure it out as we go.
Yeah, and I'll add that we, over the past couple of weeks, have also brought our criminal justice reporter on full-time. It formerly been a part-time reporter, which has been, you know, a big priority of mine for a while. So I was thrilled by that, and he's doing fantastic work on his coronavirus reporting related to the criminal justice system.
So I think that the message for us is, yes, we are concerned about our fiscal stability, but we are not shrinking. We're growing, and we're hoping that the readers, those that can, because we're well aware of, and many of us are experiencing it within our own homes, that there are folks who are unemployed and worrying about their next meal, and not unsympathetic to that, but also recognizing that there are people who have the means and the interest and the ability to help that reporting get out to a broader public. So that's important to us.
One more question. First to get the right answer gets a gold star for the week. What is the best email address for people who want to offer news tips to The Lens, our reporters, and our audience?
There's two good ones. There is editor@thelensnola.org. And you can also, contact my email address, which is C Maldonado. That's C as in Charles, MALDONADO, @thelensnola.org.
And Karen, when people call to complain about the quality of the podcast, think they need another podcast host with a better accent, how do they reach you?
I can be reached also at editor@thelensnola.org or Kay Gadwa, that is KGADBOIS, @thelensnola.org. And I do think you should start these podcasts with reporting live from my car.
We are once again recording at the Mid-City Media Center. I want to thank Charles Maldonado, our chief editor, and of course Karen Gadwa, founder and director of The Lens, NOLA.org. I thank you both and hope you stay safe.
Thank you, Tom.
And that's the show for this week. Our reporting continues. It's online at thelensnola.org. We leave you this week with some more great New Orleans music. Singer-songwriter Lynn Drury with her original Come to My House. Find more of Lynn's music at our website, lynndrury.com. Note, social distancing guidelines remain in effect. I'm Tom Wright. Thank you for getting Behind the Lens.